Okay, housekeeping stuff first, I guess. Tonight is our first night on XDS. What you say is XDS. XDS is something that is a satellite downlink service for broadcast stations. So it allows them to easily pick us up and transmit us. Now, in addition to the 20 or 25 stations that we've already listed, tonight I would like to begin reading you some new ones that are just joining tonight. KAWL 1370 AM in York, Nebraska, welcome. KCOG 1400 AM in Centerville, California, or Centerville, Iowa. Boy, I'm not doing very well here, am I? Welcome. 1000 watts. KBDB 96.7 FM in Forks, Washington. 25,000 watts. A lot of watts. And here's one I'm in love with. KGUM 567 kilohertz. Is that a giveaway about what it might be? Agana, Guam. 10 kilowatts from Guam. Probably can hear them quite well in the Philippines, actually. I'll test that when I go over. KMAS 1030 AM in Shelton, Washington. 1 kilowatt. Welcome. They also have several translators. 92.9, 105.7 in Olympia, and 103.5 in Shelton. KTNH, 1070 AM in Houston, Texas, 5 kilowatts. Hello, Houston. KTKN, 930 AM in Ketchikan, Alaska, 1 kilowatt. Welcome. Also a translator on 97.5 in Craig, Alaska. KVSF 101.5 FM in Pecos, New Mexico. I'm getting the rhythm now. WDLR 1550 in Delaware, Ohio. Welcome. WJML 1340 AM Lockport, New York. 1 kilowatt. Welcome. WQTT 1270 AM in Marysville, Ohio. 500 watts. Welcome. KTOX 1340 AM, Needles, California. Welcome. Needles, cool. Just down the road, kind of. WLVL in Lockport, New York. 1 kilowatt. Welcome. So that's what I'll read tonight. We'll kind of read these as we go along. Affiliates are coming in like crazy now. And if you want, there'll be many more. If you want us on in your market, then call up your local station manager and drive them crazy. All right, my UFO dream. This is nothing short of hilarious. I mentioned a dream one night I had on the air about a UFO, right? When was it? A couple weeks ago? Somebody went out and produced my dream in video, 3D animation video. It's at artbell.com. If you want something that's probably, you've got to see it. It's one of the funniest things you've ever seen. A dream put into 3D animation. I'm going to play the audio from it here, but trust me, it doesn't do justice. You need to go to artbell.com, and you need to see this. I about fell off the chair when Keith sent it to me earlier. Here's the audio from it, but go see the video. I had the weirdest dream last night. I had a dream about a UFO. How often does that occur? I was in a bus. And I had a camera, right? And I was going out of my mind because there was this plain to see UFO up ahead in my dream. And so I went to the front of the bus trying to get, you know, a decent picture of the thing, which was just ahead of us hovering. And I couldn't get a picture of it. And then finally I did, went around a corner. So I can't remember. It was in a dream, right? What do I know? I got a picture of the UFO, or a couple of pictures, and then, you're going to love this, somehow or another I got to the UFO, and some little green guy, it wasn't really green, but an alien of some kind, reached out, grabbed my camera and took it in, and I beat on his saucer. beat the hell out of it, and out comes this arm with my camera, and I was happy. I remember in my dream being happy, and then, of course, I looked at my camera, and the two pictures of the UFO that I took were gone. Ooh, was I angry. So maybe that's, I don't know, maybe that's kind of like real life, huh? The pictures are always gone. This one was really gone. Well, that's it. You have to see the animation that goes with this. It is hilarious. What a job this guy did. Somebody, let's see, who is it? Amanda writes to me that she listened to one of my old interviews on YouTube, and she said, man, you were a lot meaner back then. Was I really mean back then? Am I not mean now? Maybe I need to get my mean on. By the way, if somebody wants to call early here, I'll take one early call. You've heard the bad news, and it couldn't be worse. It's, again, you know, in America, again and again and again, even the president said it like that again. A gunman opened fire at an Oregon community college on Thursday, killed at least a dozen people. Now that's down to 9 dead, maybe 20 wounded. The numbers are fluctuating all around. We don't know. We don't know anything about the people killed. We don't know anything about the gunman. He was in his 20s, they say, and that's all they say, really. So we don't know. I did hear one thing that he had posted something on a social media site saying it's the only way he's ever going to get in the news. Really? That was his reason? Is the only way he's ever going to get in the news? Really? You think it's so great being in the news? President Obama went on the tube and talked to the nation, and he said, you know, we're becoming numb to mass shootings, and we are. And naturally, he talked about gun control. We don't have a gun problem in America. There are a lot of guns. We have a mental health problem in America. Ronald Reagan, much to my distress, because I loved the man, but he opened up the doors of the mental health facilities and pretty much ejected everybody a long time ago, and it's never been the same since. And now we're in a worse situation now, mental health-wise. And obviously, you know, the people who lobby for guns, they're right. Guns don't kill people. People do that. And they do it because they're mentally ill. I mean, how is it not mentally ill to kill a whole bunch of people in a college because it was the only way you were going to get on the news? You know, there had to be signs. There just had to be. Oh, okay. I see somebody's calling. So let me very quickly answer the phone and try to get it on here. Okay, so line 2, you're on the air. What the hell do you want?
Oh, I'm sorry. I wanted to share a dream with you.
Well, no dreams tonight. I've got something really important to do. Get off my line.
Sorry.
Yeah, all right. Bye. Don't let it happen again. Is that what you mean? That was cruel. And if you're out there listening, I'm sorry. I can't be mean. Not really. I mean, I could be, but what would be the point? All right, coming up after the break, we've got something really special for you. Father Michael L. Maginot was born in Gary, Indiana in 1957. He's a couple of years, decade or so younger than I am. He went to Rome for theology and gained an STL degree in biblical theology in 1984. Father Mike was ordained a priest on July 2nd of 1983. He would then be later sent back to Rome to gain a JCL degree in canon law at the Pontifical Gregorian University in 2000. When he returned, he would be assigned to St. Stephen Martyr Parish as administrator, with duties also at the tribunal in the Diocese of Gary. For 3 years, he was in charge of the tribunal as judicial vicar for the diocese, then became pastor of the parish. In 2012, he was given permission by the bishop to be an exorcist for the Amon family. I'm having trouble with mouth tonight. The Amon family, I believe that is correct, in Gary, Indiana, whose case eventually would receive worldwide notoriety. It was a really serious exorcism. So, in a moment, coming up is Father Maginot. And I really think that this is one that you're going to sort of want to, I don't know, take a moment and take a deep breath and get ready for. Because it's going to be rough stuff. I mean, we're talking, I guess, about the devil here. In fact, we'll find out very early what it is we're talking about. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell with Midnight in the Desert. Mike Maginot, welcome to Midnight in the Desert.
Thank you, Art.
You're located in a cold place, right?
Near Chicago.
Near Chicago. That's a cold place. In fact, I was in Chicago in the winter, and boy, they're not kidding about the Windy City. When it gets down near zero, and the wind is going around those buildings, wow, that's about the... I lived in cold places, and that about did it. So, where to begin with you, sir? Father, is evil real?
Very much.
Okay, a lot of people doubt that, you know. In fact, a lot of people doubt a lot of things, but especially evil, both good and evil. In fact, a lot of people doubt both. I once interviewed over many months a man named Father Malachi Martin. Have you ever heard the name?
Yes.
Okay. Sort of a heretic with regard to the Vatican, but he had a lot of interesting things to say. For example, he used to say that walking down the streets of New York, he could tell when he passed a person if they were perfectly possessed. An interesting phrase. In other words, he explained it by saying, you know, well, they have a job, they have a life, and they have certain things they want in that life, money, fame, whatever it is. They've made their deal, and they're satisfied with it. Does that sound like some people perfectly possessed?
Yes, because they look pretty much like, as you said, a normal person, but they have been totally dedicated themselves to the working, you know, working with Satan against God.
Yes, sir. Is it possible that a person in a quiet moment, perhaps a moment of, I don't know, despair or greed or something, would sit down and in their own mind, I mean, you know, we have this classic movie definition of the devil trotting in with horns and a contract that you have to sign, but you really could make your pact with the devil quietly, silently, and all by yourself, right?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Can a curse cause somebody to be possessed?
That is becoming more common than people think.
Really?
Because a curse would be put on someone by one who would be perfectly possessed, willing, someone who has dedicated themselves to working totally against God, working with Satan, has invited him into their life, and it is in that relationship that Satan, the devil, tries to get them to do more and more of his work, which they are usually most willing to go along with. Occasionally, there does come the time when they can go no farther. And that's probably when we get called in, because now they will fight against that relationship.
Okay, if I might. So if we consider, for example, somebody who's perfectly possessed, and I don't know, their deal with the devil was, I want to rise to the top of my business, and somebody gets in their way, that perfectly possessed person could, in effect, put a curse against somebody in their way and have something bad happen to them.
Yes, to do that, they would usually have to first develop a friendship with that person. It usually starts, they actually are trying to get them on board with themselves, with Satan. You know, so it is maybe a mentoring or some sort of relationship that is developed as a, like a friendship.
Mm-hmm.
But in the course of that, they also want to make sure that that friendship is maintained. And so they want to get a personal object of that person, something very special to them.
Wow.
Or else they could also give something to that person that that person would consider to be very special. And so that forges the bond between the person. So you have to establish that first. And then it's usually only when that person turns away from them then that they use that object to form a curse. And it's kind of to get them back, to intimidate them, to scare them. But usually it has the opposite effect. It drives them further, further away. But that's... And it takes a ritual, you know, to come to do that. So that's why you have to be perfectly possessed.
Father, you know,
to do a ritual that way.
Right. What you have described, particularly involving the personal object or maybe a lock of hair or whatever, and then a ritual, this sounds, I have interviewed witches on the air,
mm-hmm.
Father.
Mm-hmm.
Probably not to my credit, but I do interview witches. And frankly, that is exactly what they say that they need to do their job of some kind of spiritual warfare, they call it.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds about right?
Yeah, so it is the sending of some demon to them. Now, it's a demon that's already they are tied with, and that demon will bother them, you know, until they would... have it be sent to someone else.
Ooh.
So,
okay. We also have talked on this program about the next thing, and that is generational curses. People claim that they have generations of their family that have had curses laid on them. This happens? It is effective?
Yeah, that would be like from mother to daughter, usually. That's the usual way, mother to son. Occasionally father, you know, to child as well. But it seems, tends to be women more pass that on to their children. And it is usually those that are involved in occult type of practices, you know, Santeria, voodoo, mm-hmm. things like that.
Would it be your view, Father, that people who toy around with things like Ouija boards are possibly calling forth things they're not going to be so happy that come?
Yeah, so that's the second way of kind of inviting a demon into your life. Now, they can never... There's the normal way that any... devil, demon comes to a person, and that's through what's normally allowed by God is temptation. Any demon could tempt you, and that's pretty much putting an idea in your head. They speak to us telepathically that way. So you get this strange idea in your head, and that any person is open to that experience. To go further, then it would need an invitation on our part to invite a demon more into our lives beyond that. And so Ouija boards, tarot cards, palm reading, fortune telling, those kind of occult practices, seances, they are ways to open up our lives to having a demon to have further control in it. Now, a lot of times, curiosity is the first thing that kind of gets people to go into that. And probably the best thing to happen to a person would be they get scared of that and never touch it again.
Right.
But the demon working that doesn't really want that experience. They want to intrigue us and entice us and, you know, encourage us to go further and further with them. But it does have, that's kind of the risk they take, you know, when they kind of see something happening, either the person will get scared and stop it or get intrigued and get more involved in it. And so that's where it starts to begin. We open the door to them in our lives. But once you open that door, they don't, we lose control on when we could tell them to leave, because now they kind of have taken control. We have given them that opportunity. And so when we don't want them anymore, they're going to fight that. And that's, again, when we kind of get called, is because they want us to get more and more involved in their business, their life. And when we don't want it, we want to break it, then they're going to go from kind of a friendship type of thing to an attack, and turn on us, to intimidate us, so they'll go from enticement to fear.
Right. Father, have you ever, how long have you been a priest now? How many years?
32 years.
32 years. In that time, have you ever had weak moments in your own faith, or have you felt your faith challenged? That's a hard question. You can say, I'd rather not answer that.
Yeah. I mean, there are always challenges, but I don't think anything that was really... I guess probably the biggest time would have been when I did leave the seminary. There was... I had a girlfriend, and so I left the seminary my sophomore year in college, and so I had to deal with that. And but I did come, you know, and ended up seeing that no, I was called to be a priest, and came back. But that was a difficult time.
Boy, that must have been rough, indeed, very rough. And I, you know, it was sort of an impertinent question. I probably shouldn't have asked, but as we go on tonight, it may be that people will understand the reason for it. I think you've also had opportunities to see your faith strengthened enormously, and we'll talk about that. We've got the long break we talked about is here, and then we'll come back and really get going. Father, stand by.
Dark Matter News. I'm Leo Ashcraft. Well, you can leave it to Haunted Skeptic to always come up with something odd. This one is about astronauts' coffee, and it's made from what? Well, the cost to transport drinking water to space used to cost around $15,000 a pint. So engineers got to work. In an effort to reduce excess waste and weight, NASA started a recycling program aboard the International Space Station. A purification system was implemented, and by 2009, astronauts were recycling their own waste, turning it into potable drinking water. Earlier this year, ESA astronaut Samantha Cristoforetti brought on board the ISSpresso machine, a promising new contraption that would bring real coffee to station crew members. But how's it made? According to NASA and Italian Space Agency Operation Protocols, well, we won't get into all that technical stuff, but long story short, the special brew is derived from none other than astronaut urine. Mm-mm-mm. The best part of waking up. Well, maybe someone has captured a UFO. Haunted Skeptic sends us this follow-up report on the misidentification of the launch of NASA's Atlas V shuttle that was launched last week over Cape Canaveral in South Florida. Thanks to others recording the phenomenon, one user was able to capture what appears to be a chevron-shaped UFO traveling upward at enormous speeds during the same time frame that the NASA event took place. While the user seems to be unaware of the Atlas V launch taking place, he still manages to capture this spectacular video. You've got to take a look at it. Let us know what you think of this interesting aerial phenomenon. Do you have any viable explanations? Could it be a UAV, a hoax, or some other artificially occurring byproduct of last week's shuttle launch? Take a look at the video and let us know what you think. DarkMatterNews.com. Use the new Real or Hoax buttons to voice your opinion. A team of engineers has reportedly created an ROV, a remotely operated vehicle, for deployment to the Great Barrier Reef that will issue a lethal injection to an invasive species of starfish thought to be attributing to the destruction of coral life. The underwater robot will administer a dose of bile salts, which are toxic to the crown of thorn starfish. These creatures are listed in the top 100 most invasive species, being found accountable for the loss of some 40% of native aquatic life in the region. The robot will cruise between 2 to 3 feet from the bottom of these estuaries, looking to target these predators using a complex algorithm working with sensors in cooperation with the bot's onboard cameras. This sensing system has reportedly been optimized to minimize effects of the poison, reaching and doing harm to non-target species. According to one engineer, if the robot is unsure that something is actually a crown of thorn starfish, it takes a photo of the object to be later verified by a human, and that human feedback is incorporated into the robot's memory bank. The robot, named Kotzbot, is still in the development phase, and initially all targeted wildlife will require human confirmation before the toxin is injected. The team planned to automate the process, deploying fleets of the killer bots in order to scan and seek targets without human help. Well, what do you think of the idea of allowing robots to autonomously seek out and destroy another living species, invasive or otherwise? Does it challenge our reluctance not to intervene in nature where we could be witnessing a case of survival of the fittest? I'm Leo Ashcraft, Dark Matter News.
Well, all right. This is going to be quite a program. Father Maginot did an exorcism that made nationwide, maybe worldwide news, and you're going to hear about it. It was a very serious one with witnesses before, and it's really complicated and amazing what he did. And the reason I asked him about his faith was, without going into the details of the exorcism yet, we'll get to that, it just seems to me that coming face-to-face with whatever it is you came to face-to-face with, the devil or a demon, that would be actually a faith-affirming moment. Would that be right, Father?
Oh, yes, definitely, because dealing with a demon, they have an intelligence that is far superior to ours and very manipulative, and so we do have to have it based on a faith in God who is more powerful, or else we would come to think that without that, that what we are facing is the most powerful thing we ever seen.
Yes.
But knowing that God is more powerful, it is that protection that enables us to carry out that.
I mean, if anybody ever doubted God, certainly coming face to face with the demon or with the devil, that would do the trick, it seems to me. Anyway, before we move on, Father, today something awful happened again up in Oregon at a community college, and a guy went in with a rifle of some kind and shot apparently 9 dead, maybe 20 wounded. And our president came on and talked to the nation about it, and you could see that our president was very dejected, and it is, I completely understand, it is so mystifying to me and so many others when this sort of thing happens, and again, and again, and again, and again, and it's almost like something. I mean, there was a quote on social media, Father, that said the guy said something like, "It's the only way I'll ever get in the news." Yeah. Hmm. And so the other thing Father Malachi Martin said is that possession is up hundreds of percent in New York City and nationwide, he thought, as well. And, you know, I'm not sure where else we go for an explanation. I'm not the gun lobby, but, Father, it's not the guns. It's people's decisions to use them that's going on here. It's mental health. It's or maybe it's what we're talking about. What do you think?
Yeah, the devil does have all kinds of tools that get us into his world, which is hatred of mankind. And now, in my particular case, an exorcism, which is a ritual, pretty much only works against evils that were ritualized in. You know, as we were talking about curses and Ouija boards and
yes.
playing with the occult and things like that.
That's right.
But he also has many other tools that are more, say, normal. But exorcisms wouldn't work on that. But they do take possession of the person from beginning with different addictions like alcohol, gambling, sex addiction, also video games, and those types of things also kind of take possession of the person slowly but surely. And they start out perhaps maybe as good things. There's, you know, whenever anything is done in moderation, it's a good or the purpose that was designed by God, because, you know, God does give us good things or enable us to create good things to kind of let loose the endorphins that he created in us to help us to get that little oomph so that we could do difficult things that are responsibilities.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's nice to have a nice balance between those things. So there's things we like to do that help us to do the responsibilities or duties that we also need to carry out. And to have that nice balance in life is very good. But the problem with addictions and such, with endorphins and such, is there's a law of diminishing returns.
Oh, yes.
And so we think to do it again is going to, you know, keep that high going, but it actually it diminishes, and that's in God's design, because it's only those things are just there to give us a boost to help us deal with the more difficult, normal things of life that we have to deal with, and so they don't get us down completely. And so, but when we just go and do them over and over and over, then that defeats the purpose. And so it's not putting the little spice of life in each little, you know, in these things that we enjoy doing to enable us to live, you know, and do the things that God also wants us to do, which are sometimes difficult, the daily drudgeries.
All right, but Father, this thing of people just suddenly deciding to walk into schools and kill children.
Yeah.
You know, there's something going on here that's way, way beyond my understanding.
Yeah, that's probably something, you know, we need to see what does lead people to that. Because it does have to, something brought about a meaninglessness in their life, you know, that all of a sudden, you know, that's a long thing that Satan had to do to drag a person down into thinking that, you know, their life is meaningless, and the only thing that's left for them to do is to kill a whole mess of people so they could get on the news. I mean, for a person to come to that level, it takes a long, long time of.
One would think. Or is it possible, I mean, is it possible that a demon can grab somebody's thoughts, maybe a person who's already weak due to one of the things that you described, and put the thought in their mind to just go and do this horrid kind of thing?
Yeah. So it does, they would have to lose the purpose that God had for them in their life. And so it is something that seemed to be a good that has taken hold of them. And the more it takes hold of them, and the more it keeps them away from doing what God wants them to do. And so all of a sudden their life turns to be meaningless, and they kind of get into despair, and there's nowhere else to turn, and then there's a hatred of themselves, and you know that turns to a hatred toward others, and so it is the very process a demon, a devil uses to get us into a hell, you know, away from God so much that all of a sudden there doesn't seem to be anything else out there except what he suggests. Now, but the person has to be brought to that point before they would do something like that.
So that's a process you're describing. It's not instant. It's a process.
No, it's a long, yeah. So that just didn't happen overnight. It's not like, you know, we get to be tempted, oh, let's go to the school and take our gun and shoot
yes,
everyone.
Yes.
You know, that doesn't happen. Yeah, that for a person to get to that point, the devil has been working on them a long time, slowly taking possession. Now, we always have free will, and we're always free to come to get away from that, but there does come to see this cycling darkness that, you know, as we get involved in something over and over and over to the point that we're no longer, you know, doing what God created us to do, and we're, you know, and it seems this dark, hopeless thing that we finally come to the point where the devil wanted us to mm-hmm. do this type of thing. And so I think we do need to see when a person is cycling down, you know.
Well, there's my point.
To get them out of that.
Yeah, why doesn't somebody see this cycling, you know, either parents
yeah.
or friends or
yeah.
fellow students or, my gosh, somebody
yeah.
has got to be seeing this go on. If mm-hmm. you say it's a process, the long process you talk about, I don't know. There's no answers that make any sense to me. To what end, Father, do demons possess the living? In other words, what is the point to the demon? Why are they jealous? Do they want to have physical bodies, or feel they have physical body, or what? Why?
It probably goes all the way back to the very beginning, because a demon is a fallen angel, and in the very beginning, the book of Genesis doesn't really speak about the creation of angels, but we kind of have a hint of it in the first verse, that in the beginning, when God created heaven and the earth, there was this formless void, there was this chaos, and it's before the visible universe was created with the light. And so there was the creation of the invisible universe of the spirits created in God's image and likeness, but they didn't really have anything to do. So it's kind of chaotic. They're free will, but, you know, they're kind of just bumping into, have nothing to do, kind
right.
of bumping into each other.
Right.
So it's kind of a chaotic mess. And so God now will create the visible universe. And so he created light, and the first person who carried out the light is Lucifer, who means light bearer. And so he was the first creature given a job to take care of the light, to bear it. And then God gave other commands, and then, you know, then all the angels, the whole invisible creation now became involved in the visible creation. And we're involved in all kinds of things.
You're saying at the beginning now, let me get this straight, at the beginning Lucifer was the keeper of light.
Yeah, so Lucifer was the highest of the angels. So he carried out the very first task of God, the very first order, command. So God said, let there be light, and there was light. So God created the light, and Lucifer bore that light, carried it.
Lucifer doesn't have that light anymore, though, right?
No. Now, he considered himself to be, he knew he was the greatest. He was the first asked by God, and so he had that idea that he's the greatest. Then when God created, and then there was now everything went from good to very good with the creation of man in his image and likeness. He then, when God rested, he then, and creation was complete. He then gave Lucifer the second command, and he wanted him to now take care of man, to be his guardian angel, to be the guardian angel of Adam.
Really?
Now, that was very insulting to him because he felt he was the greatest of creatures, and man was kind of the, even though he was created in God's image and likeness, and there was also one thing that Lucifer's a little bit jealous of, too, was that man was given the command to be fruitful and multiply. He could reproduce like all the other living things of God's creation can mm-hmm. reproduce. An angel can't, so that they can't reproduce. So
contrary to what many people think, the devil, Lucifer, cannot reproduce or do anything with a human woman.
No, actually, in Genesis, there was a suggestion
uh-huh.
that that there was this that created the flood. Was that actually Lucifer? Before I get into that, let me just kind of complete the thought.
Sorry, go ahead.
Because he felt that man, which was a lesser creature than himself, should serve him. Instead of what God was asking him to serve man, so he had an idea that of a master-slave relationship is the proper order for creation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, God, as a father, had the idea that his order is that the greater serves the lesser. So it's a father, son, you know, parent, child,
yes.
a mother taking care of a baby really? Type of. A relationship,
mm-hmm.
and so it was these two mentalities that now came in conflict. Now, when Lucifer refused to do that, he was now going to show God who's boss, and he was going to, you know, not do what God wanted, but what he was going to enslave man. And so he was going to turn man away from God, away from his command, and have him do what his bidding. And so, and when he came to actually lower himself, so he went from being the highest creature to now lowering himself
mm-hmm.
To kind of crawling on the earth and embracing the earth and taking over the earth, so to speak. But that was and eating its dust and all this kind of stuff. So he lowered and he ceased to be that angel of light and now became a serpent, now became crawling on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, again, so that mankind would also lose what God designed for it and come to join him in the same way. And so that would begin the great battle. And so it went from a relationship of love to one of domination. And so would be mankind would kind of give into that. Then once Lucifer, Satan saw that he no longer had his high position, And he was jealous, became jealous and hateful of man because now man seemed to be able to do something he couldn't do, which was reproduce. And so now he had to come up with a way to try to reproduce using man, cooperation. And so it seemed like he formed what is known as the Nephilim, which is a race of giants that made mankind so evil. And it's kind of ancient times, medieval times, there would be demons that were known as incubi and succubi.
Right.
So the incubus is one who would attack a female, and a succubi is one who attack a male. So he seemed to kind of what I think in our modern times we see this activity more as aliens, extraterrestrials doing this, but where he would come to take the seed of man, the sperm, a man, join it with an egg of a woman, and implant it in the woman so that the woman would give birth to a child, but outside of the plan of God.
Hybrid.
And so instead of God implanting a human soul in that, he could enter into that and be take that body, possession of that body. And so there came to be that race of giants, these demonized human beings that started to grow up, which corrupted the world so bad that God had to destroy it and start again from scratch with Noah and such.
All right, Father, we've got to hold it right there. We're at a break, so stand by, and we'll be right back. Father Mike Maginot is my guest, and we're about to talk about an exorcism that he did. But a little background, and I think we're almost done with that. There is one thing, though, that bothers me. The Father said that Lucifer kept the light. And I had somebody on this program that talked about UFOs named John Lear. And I guess it'll bother me until the day I die. But John Lear said, Art, when you die, you're going to see the light and there's going to be darkness. And you're going to have a choice to make. And he said, don't go to the light. It's a trick. That's bothered me ever since I heard it, Father.
When you die? No. Actually, you do want to go to the light, toward God.
Long as Lucifer doesn't have it anymore.
No.
Oh, good.
He lost that.
That's good.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on. I mean, here you are, a priest, and you get a call, apparently, from, is it the Ammons family? Is that correct?
Amon's.
Okay, Amon's family. That's a long A. Okay, Amon's family, and they wanted your help. And why did they want your help? What was going on?
Yeah, I kind of got involved in all this by accident. I cover for the Catholic priest chaplain who works in the two Methodist hospitals in our area, one in Gary, one in Merrillville, next door. And his days off are Friday and Saturday. And so I usually get called in for emergencies.
Right.
And so on the Friday, April 20th, 2012, I was doing what I normally do on Friday morning is my Bible study class.
Mm-hmm.
And I got the call from the Methodist Hospital in Gary, from the chaplain who asked me to come over to do an exorcism. And I said, why is that? And he mentioned that this 9-year-old boy was seen by several professional staff people walking up the wall backwards and flipping over his grandmother. And they ran out of the room and they got the security to look in that. The security then called the police. They called the chaplain.
Would you mind rolling over that again? You said that he was walking up a wall backward?
Backwards, yeah. So the way it happened, it was the Child Protective Services were noticing that the three children, were missing school a lot, and sometimes when they were at school, they would have things like bloody noses, bloody gums, and different things. And so there was a lot of suspicion that something wasn't right at home.
Right.
And so they kind of got involved and asked, and it was the mother and grandmother were kind of watching over the children.
Sure.
And so they took them to their doctor to have them examine the children.
Yes.
And to see what's wrong.
Family doctor, and right?
The family doctor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so in that doctor's office, it first of all started with what would happen is this demon would jump from one child to the other. And so
wow.
It would affect one child and then Duke's crazy things, and then jump to the next one and continue probably to do about similar type of things.
So, walking up a wall backwards, that's movie stuff. I mean, do you have other people who saw this happen, witnesses?
Yeah, there's a couple of professional witnesses. One was the child protective agent, and the other one was a psychological nurse, and I think a psychiatric doctor also.
Wow.
Saw the same thing. So they were, that was at the hospital in the emergency room, which they took the children to after the doctor's office, because in the doctor's office, one boy was picked up and thrown into the wall.
What?
And before that, they were kind of growling and saying everyone must die in a very grovelly voice. And
Father, hold on.
Their eyes were rolling.
Right. Oh, no. I'm getting this, Father. Just stop for a second. It's a 9-year-old boy we're talking about right now. How many children totally?
There's three children.
Three?
The two boys are alive. They were right in the time of their birthdays. So it was like one was like 7 turning to 8. The other one was 9 turning to 10.
Right.
And then one was the girl was the oldest, was 11 turning to 12. Their birthdays were right around that time.
7, 9, and 11. Okay. And you're saying that this demon jumped between all of these children back and forth?
Yeah, it would kind of jump from one to the other when it was active. And it also, we originally found it stemmed from the mother, but no one kind of knew it at that time. But when one boy got thrown against the wall, he would kind of fall asleep, and they couldn't wake him up.
Father, do you mean up into the air and up against the wall like that?
Yeah, they saw him like be picked up, thrown to the wall, and knocked down, and then he kind of fell, you know. Then he would be like unconscious,
right?
And then the second boy was also kind of acting strange. Now he was kind of saying things, you know, everyone must die, and growling and such, and then he kind of like fell asleep. You know, went unconscious. But they couldn't wake them up, either the boys. And also the doctor, when he was seeing all this, he said, I don't have no idea what all this is. This is beyond my capacity.
Hey,
I got to call the ambulance. So
yeah.
So they got two ambulances to take the two boys to the emergency room at the hospital. And
7-year-old and the 9-year-old.
So they went for, and it didn't seem to, I think the girl was there, but she didn't seem to be affected at that time. It seemed like they brought, the first thing happened to one boy, the next thing happened to the other boy, and then that's when they called the emergency, the ambulance.
Well, sure, I can imagine, only imagine a family doctor in his office seeing all this go on. It would be hands up, hands off, take them away.
Yeah. And I think the girl went with the mother and grandmother, you know, and they followed the ambulance. Child Protective Servant agent also went over there. Now, when they got to the emergency room, it's the youngest boy, it was going berserk. And so it took like five guys to hold him down. They tried to restrain him and all that. And I think they ended up finally sedating him, you know, and they kept him overnight for observation.
Sure.
And so it would be the next morning, the family would come back, the grandmother, mother, and also the girl would also come back. And in the morning, again, the one boy was kind of always talking about this boy, his friend. Now, he would see this boy in the closet at their home that would talk to him about what it's like to die, what it's like to be killed. And so, and then all of a sudden he'll start growling, and then again, you know, go uncontrollable, and then it'd take again like five guys to try to hold him down, and then they'll try to strap him into the bed, and you know, into the gurney and all that, and you know, and sedate him. Then it kind of jumped to the other boy in the other observation room.
The 9-year old.
So the 7-year old was with the mother, and then it jumped into the other boy in the other room. This is the 9-year old, and he was with his grandmother, and now he started acting strange. Now this is so that you had staff in these two rooms. Okay.
Sure.
So. And all of a sudden, when the 9-year-old started acting strange, he would start growling. He would start like hitting his grandmother headbutting her in her stomach, and says, "It's now time to die," you know. And then she would try to coax him back, calling his name, and she was holding on to his hands. And as she was trying to coax him back, calling his name, she was backing him up against the wall. And as he came up to the wall, he started to walk, like, there's two ways that it's described, that he walked up the wall. Some say he kind of like skated up the wall, glided up the wall. He was kind of lifted up the wall. So there was kind of a couple different descriptions of that. Then some say he walked on the ceiling, but he kind of flipped over his grandmother. So it was more, he flipped over his grandmother, sat in the chair, and then looked at everyone who was kind of in that room, and gave this like Grinch-like grin, you know, to them. And his eyes were white. You know, so, and they ran, and everyone who was in that room ran out.
Definitely what I would have done. This is really scary stuff. And you're saying there's plenty of witnesses to all of this.
Yeah.
I've got somebody who said, yes, yes, yes. It was on Fox News. It's been all over the place. So this is that case. My goodness. Continue, Father. I don't know what to say.
So when I heard that story, I said, okay, there is something there. But I explained to them, yeah, I can't do anything now. I have to get permission from the bishop to do this, and I need to do an investigation. But I am willing to meet with everyone. And so I feel free to give them my contact information, and I'll meet with them as soon as possible.
Right.
And so what ended up happening is the three children were taken away from the parents, away from the mother and grandmother. So two of them were, the two older ones were put in to with the Carmelite sisters in the area that take care of foster children.
Right.
But the 7-year-old who, you know, it took like five guys to hold down, and
yes,
and who was talking about, you know, what it's like to die and such, and seeing the boy in the closet at his home and such, he was taken to a children's psychiatric lockdown unit in another hospital, you know, psychiatric hospital in another part of our area here.
So at this point, even after all of this and all of these witnesses, you're still not involved in the sense of doing an exorcism. I mean, you would think that when any medical person saw any of what you just described, they would, you know, that's not in any of the books I read when I was becoming a nurse or a doctor. No way.
Yeah.
So I guess that's when were you then involved?
So I then contacted the mother and grandmother contacted me. They mentioned their children were taken away. And I said, okay, I can meet with you at the home, at your home on Sunday evening after my last Mass. I have a 5 o'clock Mass. I'm done at 6. So I could get there about 6:30. So I went to their home at 6:30 and was there for about 4 hours to do an investigation.
Right.
And the first 2 hours were pretty much them telling the whole story. And it all kind of started when they moved into the house. And the reason she moved into the house was that she was trying to get away from her ex-boyfriend, whom she found out was a married man, when her his wife called her. I guess she discovered her phone number on his, you know, his phone.
Found her.
And says, "What are you doing with my husband?" And she says, "Oh, I didn't know he's married. Don't worry. This relationship is over." And it kind of explained a lot of things. But she did say something that was kind of strange. And she said, "You will regret ever messing with my husband." And she said, "Well, don't worry. This is over." You know, but he wouldn't let it go. And so he kept on kind of stalking her almost. And so she felt the best way was to move away and not let him know where they're going. So her brother's landlord said that there was a house available very cheap. And so and they went to see it, and so they decided to move in there. And but I guess the boyfriend eventually found out where she moved to. Probably he followed her from work or something like that, and eventually found where she was living at, and then started to show up again. But when they moved into the house, it seemed to be things. First of all, they saw all kinds of horseflies. And this is about November, so it's kind of, you know, kind of late in the season for that. But, you know, so especially on the porch. And they were usually these, a lot of dead horseflies. And so they would sweep them up. And the next day they'll find a whole mess of more. And they kept on sweeping up the horseflies.
Wow.
Then one time she saw someone walking back and forth, pacing in their living room. I think this was the grandmother. And she thought someone broke into their house. So when she jumped out of bed and turned on the light, no one was there. But when they looked on the ground, on the floor, there was muddy foot prints.
Wow.
And they seemed to come up from the basement area. And then later on, they would hear footsteps coming up the basement. And so the way they kind of dealt with that was to put a lock on the door from the kitchen to the basement. And then all of a sudden they would hear footsteps coming up the steps and then pounding on the door.
Oh, good Lord.
And when they would go and open it, they would see no one. And then other times they would hear dogs barking out there, and then they would open up that door but not see anything.
Father, especially with regard to somebody coming up the steps to the locked door from the basement and pounding on the door, and then nobody being there. No offense, but how does anybody stay in a house with that kind of action going on? I just, you know, you see it in movies, and you're sitting here screaming, "Get the heck out of that house!" And of course, they never do. And I guess they had a good deal on this house, so and they didn't have a lot of money, so no choice.
Yeah, they were kind of trapped. So that's usually the one thing that keeps people from moving out. They have, you know, they sign a lease and things, and so they would be liable to pay the whole thing, and so they really didn't have anywhere else to go, and so it was kind of livable in the early part. It seemed to escalate through the winter time. To, as I mentioned, the kids were starting to wake up with blood on their pillows and bloody noses, bloody gums, bloody lips, and things like that. But they couldn't see, you know, there's no, the blood would just kind of appear out of nowhere and, you know, then kind of go away.
Was it at that point, when you interviewed Mom and Grandma, at that point, were they noticing that this was moving from child to child?
Yeah, it was. They didn't see it like be jumping, but it would like affect one child one day, then another one another day, and another one another day, and such. So it was never was it two at the same time. So they didn't kind of see that later. They would see something happening to the one child, but it would affect all three. And it wouldn't be till they kind of saw later that. You know, never was two things happening to two of them at the same time.
I see. All right. You had a pretty good, long, substantial interview with Mom and Grandma. I guess Mom was Latoya Ammons, is that correct?
Yes, Latoya, yes.
Latoya, okay. What did you come away with from that interview? What did you make of her?
Yeah, actually, because I was always trying to figure out, when you're doing this, you're trying to figure out what's the source of this, what brought this in.
Right.
And now we're trying to do this without the kids there, you know, because they're there. So,
of course, yes.
And she didn't know quite, you know, so I'm asking, what do you think, you know, did they get involved in, you know, kind of, did they play a game, you know, Ouija board, video game, you know.
Right.
We're trying to, and they pretty much, we couldn't come up with anything like that. Latoya then was mentioning that she also started to have kidney ailments and went to the doctor three times, like in January, with three different kidney ailments. Mm-hmm. And then one time, the only time the grandmother seemed to be affected was one time she was washing clothes in the basement, and all of a sudden something choked her. And she had to get out of the basement. But that was the only time she was ever attacked. But she did mention one time she saw all kinds of sand in the basement strewn over the floor. And so she had to sweep it up. And it was like two buckets worth of sand that she had to sweep up from the basement and throw it outside. And then everything seemed to escalate with... the last time the boyfriend came over to the house. Now, they would never let, she didn't want anything to do with the boyfriend, would always tell her, go back to your wife, we're, you know, this is over with and such. And he would keep on showing up, and, you know, and they would try to keep, you know, just tell him, you know, to go. But the last time he came to the house, he wanted to give the boys $5 each, but he didn't give anything to the girl. And I kind of found that strange, and I asked, why was that? I think Latoya was at work when that happened, and Rosa, the grandmother, was calling her and says, he's here, and says, get rid of him. And he says, he wants to give the boys something. What does he want to give them? $5 each. And he said, okay, that's okay. But I asked, why did he give something to the boys and nothing to the girl? And Rosa said that he said that that the boys needed this incentive to be good, but the girl didn't. But it just struck me. There's something bizarre in all that. And so 3 days later is when kind of everything escalated in the house. And it was a family gathering. Their whole family was at the house. And all of a sudden, the girl gets, they're all sitting in the living room and such, and the girl gets pulled off the couch, and she's landed on the floor. And everyone looks at her and says, "What are you doing?" She says, "Someone pulled me off the couch." And then she started, "Oh, my stomach's hurting," and such. She was feeling sick, and then they would kind of take her to her room, and they were kind of trying to take care of her, and she's feeling nauseous. They would see her stomach kind of bulging, you know, and such, and
really?
And her legs kind of bulging and all that. And then they Rosa went to the kitchen to get a washcloth so she could put on her head. And all of a sudden, behind her, in their living room, they had a freezer, and because there wasn't room in the kitchen. And all of a sudden, one of the boys got thrown into the freezer. And she turned around, and everyone heard this big boom, and, you know, and said, "What happened to you?" And said, "Someone threw me into the freezer." And then he started to get sick.
Now, wait a minute. This is, Father, this is a freezer that is closed, right?
This is like a, you know, like a refrigerator freezer. So it's a, yeah, but it's in the living room because they didn't have room in their kitchen for it.
So it like opened and he went flying.
It's a closed freezer, but okay. He got thrown like at the doctor's office. He got thrown up against it, and everyone just heard the boom and turned around and saw him. You know, they thought he ran into it. He said, "No, someone threw me into the freezer." And he says, "There's no one else around here," you know. So then he started getting sick. And so they then took him into the bedroom. And the same things were happening to him. He was feeling nauseous. His stomach was, you know, bumps were appearing. And his legs, bumps were, and bulges and things were appearing.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, the third boy was in the bathroom, and he got thrown out of the bathroom and went, you know, flying. And everyone turns around and says, what happened to you? And he says, "Someone threw me out of the bathroom." And then all of a sudden he got sick, you know, the same way.
Right.
And with that, then everyone's leaving. You know, I said, we're getting out of here. This is bizarre.
Right.
And so they kind of heard some of the stories before of what was happening, but this is the first time the family actually witnessed what was going on. And so all the family leaves except for a cousin. And she asked her parents if she could stay overnight with the girl, and they said that was okay. And so everyone left. And so they're kind of getting ready for bed. You know, everything seemed to settle down, and they turn off the lights in the bedroom and such. And Rosa and I and Latoya were about ready to get into bed and such. And they heard this scream, and they come running into the bedroom, and open the door and turn on the light, and they see their daughter fall onto the bed. And the cousin said that she screamed because the girl was 2 feet off the bed, levitated.
Oh, okay.
And the girl didn't know. She woke up, you know, after she fell on the bed, and she didn't know anything, you know, what happened. And so they now kind of saw, well, we better do something. Before they were Baptist, but their church wouldn't help them out with the other things earlier. But Rosa's mother, who was kind of a shut-in in an apartment, had a neighbor who belonged to this deliverance church. They do deliverance services.
Yes.
And so Rosa tried to call her mother and to have them come over to see if they could do anything for the but it took all kinds of different things were happening interfering with their phone calls, you know. So she would call them one would call the other, and one would hear them, but wouldn't hear the other. And then the other one would call back, and you could hear the one, but not the other.
Electronic interference.
So it's like electronic interference. Then all of a sudden, they would call again, and there was this, you know, staticky, but it sounded like a voice in the static, you know, growling and things. And then in one of the calls back, they said that there was a whole series of zeros on their phone as the number. But eventually they finally got enough that they would send, she would talk to her neighbor, and the neighbor would have the church send people over that Tuesday. And so...
All right, Father, hold it there. It's a natural break point, I guess, or maybe not natural. How do you break this story at all? So you're hearing a story of possession, and you're going to hear a story of exorcism. This was a nationwide, worldwide story. I'm Art Bell. This is Midnight in the Desert.
For Dark Matter News, I'm Leo Ashcraft. Canadians have created a giant wall that sucks carbon dioxide straight out of the air. Created by the Canadian company Carbon Engineering, this wall could be built to draw carbon dioxide straight out of the air and convert it into fuel.
We're capturing CO2 with it right now. And by the time we get to the outlet here, where these fans pull the air through the contactor, over 80% of the CO2 has been removed. We're trapping over 100 kilos of CO2 here every day, and that CO2 gets absorbed into our solution and forms a type of carbonate salt.
Air flows through a row of massive fans that are connected to a carbon dioxide-rich solution. This then absorbs carbon compounds out of the air. This solution is purified with the carbon dioxide within it extracted, and then purified again for reuse. The research and engineering firm hope to build such walls where regrowth of trees simply isn't possible. They did it in the 60s, and they're still doing it. A strange gray UFO has caused something of a stir in the conspiracy community after NASA caught the object on its ISS live feed camera and then promptly cut the live feed as soon as it appeared. The small gray object is seen coming up over the horizon and then disappearing just moments later as NASA cuts the feed and switches to another of the cameras, and will no doubt fuel conspiracy theorists' belief that NASA is deliberately hiding footage of potential UFOs. One of the simplest theories to this conundrum is that it's an artifact on the lens, or indeed the moon. The YouTuber responsible for the video, StreetCap1, doesn't hold with that either, posting a second video that he says proves that it couldn't be the moon. The biggest mystery, however, is why NASA didn't just use duct tape to cover it up. That's what they did before, after all. Right? I'm Leo Ashcraft, and this is Dark Matter News. A former state trooper from Washington said on Wednesday that he is currently in contact with several Bigfoot creatures and that he feeds them food regularly. The man, who provided a name but chose to remain anonymous, said that the encounters have been happening since 2009 in a remote area in the North Cascades. He said sometimes it's 5 to 10 minutes, other times they stay for hours. He says he leaves them apples, carrots, beef jerky, cookies, and candy bars. The man says he was looking for an old mine in the mountains the first time he came across the alleged beings in 2009. After leaving the food out there for him, he says they seem to have started following him and getting closer. He says he's been as close as 20 feet to some of them. He reports that he was so close to them that he was able to catch some of their language on two different occasions. He said it sounded like Native American and an Asian mix. The creatures reportedly stand between 6 and 7 feet tall and probably weigh in at about 500 pounds, females being a little lighter. He describes them as having a human face, some with dark hair, others red or brown, probably about 3 to 4 inches long, adding that the females had small breasts. He claims he's not the only one to have seen the creatures in the area. Numerous people have also purportedly seen them while accompanying the man. The former state trooper says the creatures have never presented a threat to him and that he leaves them alone and he's not interested in hunting them or gathering physical evidence. Florida resident John Byrd last year claimed to feed Bigfoot potatoes and plantains on a regular basis. In the spring of 1982, a soldier training at Fort Leonard Wood Army Base in Missouri claimed to have spotted a 7-foot-tall creature with brown hair that resembles the former state trooper's alleged sighting. Portions on the United States side of the range are part of the North Cascades National Park. Earlier this week, there were reports revealing the intentions of the U.S. Army to annex part of the region as a helicopter training area, drawing criticism from the Forest Service employees for environmental ethics. I'm Leo Ashcraft. This has been Dark Matter News.
Let's go back to it. Father, you mentioned that they contacted the church they were familiar with, right?
They tried first with them, but they didn't deal with anything like that. So they ended up contacting the church of Rosa's mother, Latoya's grandmother,
right.
Who was they came over on that Tuesday, and so it was like a team from the church, which included someone who's kind of sensitive to spirits.
Right.
And she went in, and she was drawn immediately into the basement. And when she went down into the basement, she came running out and saying, your house is full of demons, And so what do you want us to do? And she said, I can't stay here. So they suggested various things for her to try to do.
Right.
And so, like, take oil and put crosses on all the entries, on the doorways and on the windows, to kind of use bleach or ammonia or something to wash down the walls in the basement, to set up like an altar get some sage incense and kind of have that go, burn down there and sprinkle salt all through the basement. So they did kind of all these different things. And then they would also invite them to bring the children to the church. I think Wednesday, they had a special service on Wednesday and then later on Sunday. And so when they went next day to the Wednesday services, the children were kind of giving them all kinds of difficulties on going there. And so it would seem like they were all... things were all right in the house, but once they got outside, one kid would go, they'd be running all over the place, wouldn't get into the car. And once they would get, one in the car, then they had to kind of, the other one would run all over the place. So they finally got all three into the car. And then, one would start, like, banging their head on the window. Another one would bang their head, maybe on the headrest and just do all kind. Then it would go to the other one who kind of roll their head around and such. So they're trying to,
Demons mostly don't like to go to church.
Yes. So it's giving all kinds of trouble. Mm-hmm. And then when they finally got into the church, it would seem like one would have to go to the bathroom, and then that one would come back, and the other one would go to the bathroom, and then come back, and then the other one would go to the bathroom, and they were just kind of just being very, very, like herding cats type of thing.
Right.
And all over, they were just, so it was very difficult. So they were trying to, and I think eventually the kids would just kind of fall asleep one by one, and then they would kind of wake them up, and I think they tried, so it was very disruptive, so they weren't really able to do much, so they invited them to come back on Sunday. But I think the same thing happened, but it was even more violent. And now Rosa and Latoya were kind of helping each other, but Rosa said, I'm not going to miss church, so you have to deal with it. So Latoya could never get them into the car and such. So they ended up never, so she's so, okay, it's too late to get to church. And then the kids calmed down and they went back inside and Rosa came back. And so they decided, well, we're not going to be able to get them to church. And so shortly after that, they would end up leaving the house because they were all kind of sitting around the living room watching TV, and this Febreze bottle levitated off the coffee table and went back and forth. in the living room, and they got thrown into LaToya's room, and they heard this huge explosion. And when they looked into the room, they saw that it knocked down her lamp and broke her lamp. But right next to it was the closet, and that's where all five of them saw this huge black monster-like thing with red, red eyes.
Red eyes.
And they say, well, grab some clothes, and we're getting out of here. And so they went to a hotel.
It's so understandable. I mean, at this point, they wouldn't really be thinking of possession of the children or anybody. They would be thinking, we live in a haunted house.
So that was the last time they went to the house so they went to a hotel, but they could only afford one night. And then they finally went to relatives, to, I think, her brother, LaToya's brother's place. But that was getting very, five people moving in.
Yes.
It was pretty cramped.
Very tough.
And such. But it was still kind of affecting the kids. They were missing school and things. And that's when the Child Protective Services would get involved. And then that's when I got involved after that.
How did you get involved? I mean, after all this went on, who was the one to contact you?
That was the Methodist chaplain at the hospital.
Really?
When the boy walked up backwards. So.
I see. So, at some point, I'm not Catholic. I'm sort of a lapsed Catholic, but I believe that there are permissions required to actually perform an exorcism, right?
Yeah. So I was going to do my investigation. So when I went to the house that Sunday night, they told me the whole story. Okay, and then so that took about 2 hours to do all that, to get up to that point. But what struck me strange was the boyfriend. And so now I was going to say, okay, tell me more about this boyfriend, because I think this is the source of it. And that's when the phenomena started to happen in the house. So the first thing was a series of interruptions, not to get me to talk, about the boyfriend.
Like what?
And the first thing was the light in the bathroom started flickering and buzzing. And I said, oh, that's strange. So I went and walked over there to take a look at it. And the moment I walked in the bathroom, it stopped. And so I went and sat down again and got my pen and everything. And, okay, tell me about the boyfriend. And again, immediately, the light in the bathroom started flickering and buzzing. So second time I went, and the moment I got to the entrance of the bathroom, it stopped. And so I walked back, and I mentioned to them, I guess it's scared of me. And immediately it started buzzing and flickering. And so I went, and this time it would let me look at it. It was buzzing and flickering. And then I went and got my crucifix, which I brought with me.
Right.
And then I went to put it even on top of the light, and it still continued. So it's being defiant, so showing me it wasn't scared. But it did show, okay, this is not a normal electric problem. This is responding. And so I wrote all that down. And I said, okay, we'll ignore all that. Let's get back to the boyfriend. And then Rose started pointing to the kitchen.
Yes.
And the rod, they had Venetian blinds on all the windows. And mm-hmm. so the rod that you twist to open up the blinds
right.
was swaying back and forth. And so I was kind of looking this, and so I went to take a closer look at it to see what could be causing it. And what was interesting was that there were the three cords that you used to open the blinds, vertically.
Right.
It had like three tags at the end of it. And all of a sudden, the furnace kicks on, and there was a vent underneath it. And then all those things were fluttering, greatly. But they weren't fluttering. And then the furnace kicks off, and then they go back to being calm. But still, through the there was no change in the movement of the stick rod moving back and forth. And then I saw from one Venetian blind to the next, and through the living room. You know, they were kind of almost like swaying. You know, in time with each other, it seemed like they were coordinated. And then the next one. Then I went to the bedroom of Rosa, and hers was also swaying. And then I went into Latoya's bedroom to see if that was also happening to her blinds. But I didn't even bother to look at them. Right down the middle of her blinds, something was dripping. Huh. And so I said, what's this? I don't remember seeing this before. Because when I first came to the house, I blessed it, you know, with holy water and such. So I went to every room and such. So I don't remember seeing, you know, this liquid dripping down the blinds.
Yes.
And she said that, yeah, when the church asked her to put oil on all their, you know, on the windows.
And oh, yes.
She made a huge sign of the cross on both blinds. Now, there was only one vertical thing, but the horizontal portion of that cross wasn't showing. And so I felt it, you know, and it was oily, you know. So, and she said at times, even though that was done like 6 weeks before, you know, she said it dry, you know, she put it on for, you know, one time, and then and that was the only time. But at times, you know, it would dry up. But at other times, it would kind of, you know, liquefy.
That's weird. Yeah.
So
that would have been dried up long since.
Long time, yeah. So I felt it was, you know, liquefying certainly. And I go, so I made a note of all that. And then I said, okay, let's get back to the boyfriend. And then Rosa points down to around here, around where Latoya was sitting. And all of a sudden it looked like wet footprints were all around her. You know, and I go, I don't remember seeing that.
You know, this is right out of a horror movie. It really is.
Yeah. And so I went to see if there were, you know, if they were just paint, you know, then they were wet. So I felt it. It was wet. You know, I could smear it. And then I was looking where it came from because I go, you know, where did these? I don't remember seeing these before.
Right.
You know, so I was, because I was in the kitchen, I was in the bathroom. So, but they were just around her. So I was wondering if I made those, you know, if I stepped in a puddle or something, and was tracking this through the house and happened to, you know. But I don't even remember walking around Latoya that way. I was always going back to my chair, but it was just around her. It wasn't out the door. Wasn't out. You know, it was just these wet. And they just appeared. I don't remember seeing them before, you know. So I then made a note of that. And then all of a sudden she said she's shivering. She's real cold. And so she went in her bedroom to get a blanket, and she put it around her. Mm-hmm. And says, okay, let's talk about the boyfriend. Then all of a sudden she throws off the blanket. So she's burning up, you know. And
wow.
And then all of a sudden she said, oh, I have a headache. And then at that point I said, do you mind if I put my crucifix on your forehead? And she said, okay. And so I put it on her forehead, and she began convulsing. And I took it off immediately, and she stopped convulsing. And I said, oh, I think you're possessed. You know, you have an aversion to holy objects. And she kind of sheepishly
said, when you say convulsed,
yeah. Like she went through in a seizure. She's just shaking.
Okay.
And then she would stop when I took it off. And then I asked Rosa if I could do the same to her. And she gave me permission. I could put it on her, Rosa, and there was no problem. And she said, so she was kind of the one least affected by all this. But I said, well, you know, I think And at that point, I looked at my watch and I saw it was 10:30. And I said, okay, I think I have enough here, but I have to get to the bottom with the boyfriend. The key is the boyfriend. So, and then we could probably do that over the phone. And so, we closed up the house and they went back to, with her brother and such.
Yeah, I think I'd want to do that on the phone too.
And so the next day, Rosa calls me and says, LaToya's very sick, but she wanted to mention something that happened that night. Because they were sleeping in the same room, and so Rosa was awakened in the middle of the night, and she saw that her feet were uncovered by the blankets, and so she tried to kind of kick the bedding back over her feet, and as she was about ready to fall asleep, she all of a sudden noticed that the bedding was coming off of LaToya's feet, and that also woke up LaToya. And so I was kind of saying, there seems to be something with feet here. So, if that makes any sense to you. And so LaToya called me the next day, and she says, that reminded me of something. The first time I met my boyfriend was that I was missing, and I never thought of this till then, that I was missing, I got a brand new pair of Air Jordans for women, and all of a sudden they were missing. I couldn't find them anywhere. And she was asking her kids, did anyone take her Air Jordans? And they all denied it. And she asked her mother, she says, what would I do with, Air Jordans? And she, and she couldn't find it, anywhere. So she was kind of surprised. And then she wanted to make a picture of the family and enlarge it. So she went through her stack of pictures and was looking for that picture she wanted to enlarge. And she also noticed other pictures missing of individuals in the family as well. And then she went again to all the family members and asked them, who took these pictures. Now she was getting angry. She says, people are stealing things, they're lying and everything. Now this is when her boyfriend just moved in. And then the first night he was there, he said something strange to her. He asked her for her underwear. And he says, what do you want that? And he says, I want to remember this evening, And he says, well, you're sick. You're crazy. You're not going to have that. So then I asked her, did he take that? And, was that missing? She says, well, I have so many pairs. I don't know if he took it. But I didn't give it to him. But he may have taken it, but I wouldn't have known.
Right.
But it was just the suggestion of it. So I said, oh, okay. So it looks like, he did some sort of, especially when you left him, he was doing some sort of curse on you and perhaps on the kids as well. And so we kind of saw the boyfriend as being
Bad guy.
The one who brought
the
in
initiator.
The
curse. Yeah.
But it also seemed there was something else in the house because later on, I think that Wednesday too.
Father, again, I'm sorry, we're at a short break. So hold that thought, and then you can describe the ultimate exorcism, right?
Sure.
Oh, good Lord, what a story. All kinds of activity. Children walking up walls. Children thrown into things. Blood coming unexpectedly from the children. Things moving in the house. The concept of the idea that for a while it was a haunted house. The efforts to deal with that. And then apparently the realization that this was an outside influence, mainly the boyfriend. And Father, so you had all of this documentation from medical professionals, what you had witnessed yourself, the family's testimony. So at some point, who do you go to try to get authorization to do an exorcism?
Yeah, to my bishop.
To your bishop. Was that a hard sell?
Yeah, because he never gave authorization before, so there was no exorcist in the diocese to go to,
right.
And so none of us had any training, and so he asked me to contact nearby ones in the Archdiocese of Chicago and the Archdiocese of Indianapolis.
Sure.
And to how to deal with that. And so they kind of gave me a quick lesson. Mainly I needed a ritual. And at that time, there was no ritual because there was a little bit of a concern. They recently revised the rite, and many of the exorcists were complaining about the new rite being not as effective. And so the Pope Benedict at that time gave permission to do the old rite, and they're going to, the church will look at the revised rite and maybe go back to the old one.
Question for you, Father. I mean, you've been a priest a very long time, but you're a novice, certainly, at exorcisms. Didn't you go into this with trepidation yourself?
Yeah, because I didn't have, but there was kind of nowhere else to go. Because you're kind of the cop on the duty, you know.
Right.
On your duty, shift. And it's your, you know, I couldn't hand it off to anyone. So
you moved to the old, you got permission, and then you moved to the old rite, the old way of doing it.
Actually, I tried the new one. So they said, you know, there is no ritual right now. You have to get it off the internet, and because no one's printing anything until they settle how we're going to do this.
I see.
So I would do the new rite in English for the first two exorcisms, but I found the most effective one was the old rite in Latin. And that was the last one, which actually took care, you know.
Did you, during the time that I assume that you went into a room with the children by yourself, or how did you do this?
No, I was just going to take care of LaToya first.
Okay.
And as it turned out, once I took care of LaToya, it also cleared from the children as well.
I see. So through the boyfriend to LaToya to the children, during this exorcism that
I never did the boyfriend.
No, I understand, but I'm tracing.
Okay.
Yeah, how this happened. You did the detective work, so from the boyfriend to LaToya and then on to the children is the way it was working. Once you got it out of LaToya, did you meet anything during this exorcism? Can you describe it in any way, or are you prohibited from doing that?
Some things I'm prohibited, but the first exorcist, first of all, what the exorcist from Indy and Chicago recommended is that I do a minor exorcism first, which is basically the rite without the bishop's permission. And if that works, great. If not, then you have to get the bishop's permission. So
right.
It's always good to try it once.
Okay.
And so I did that, and mainly the sign for LaToya was, you know, she would convulse when I put the crucifix on her. So when we got to that part of the rite, on doing that, she would convulse. And what you're trying to do is to aggravate it so that it would leave, or weaken it so that it would dissipate. But one thing you don't want it to do is to be consistent, because it's not bothering it that much, and you're actually hurting the person. And that's what was kind of happening during the minor rite of exorcism. I put the crucifix on her head. I'll probably keep it there maybe for 30 seconds or so. And there was no change. She was continual convulsion. Then I would take it off, and then she would stop. And I did that three times, and it was the same. So it really was not effective.
Father, you're going to have to excuse me, but I've only seen movies, and in the movies they use holy water.
Yeah. Now, holy water didn't seem to bother her.
Really?
Okay. So it was religious objects. But there's all kinds of things. So that was basically the only thing that was bothering her. You know, so we would go through the whole rite. Now you only go through the rite once when you're doing a minor exorcism. So right. that was the only reaction. And so I mentioned that to the bishop, and so he did give me permission. And so we set up for the first. Now that one was done in the house. And so we're going to do the major exorcism in the church, my church.
Oh.
And so we had everyone there, and we went through the whole rite one time. And when I got to the point of putting the crucifix on her forehead, she was fine. No reaction.
Wow.
And so there was this, like, it was like gone.
So you were not harmed in any way during any of this?
No, it was kind of surprising. You know, now she could, you know, so we thought, oh, that was simple.
Yes.
I think everyone else that was there was kind of, well, that's, you know, that was easy. You know, so they were really expecting a lot. And then she could wear... You know, so we gave her a crucifix. She could put it on before she couldn't. You know, she couldn't stand anything religious on her.
Right.
And we gave, and one of my assistants gave her what's known as a Benedictine rosary, which is Benedictine medals like a rosary.
Uh-huh.
And so it's a big, huge rosary here. And so she took that, and she got in her car and drove away. And so we were kind of walking across the parking lot thinking, wow, that was easy.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden we see something shiny on the ground, on the parking lot asphalt. And it was a couple pieces of the rosary, that Benedictine rosary. And then we saw another piece of it and another piece. So it was like spreads. So it was like 5-6 different pieces. And so we picked them all up, made sure we had the whole thing.
Yes.
And the person that was going to, you know, that gave it to her was going to put it back together. And so we kind of said, I don't think this is over. And so LaToya called the next day, and she wanted to know where that big rosary was. She put it in her purse and drove away. And then when she got home, she looked in the purse, and she couldn't find it. And she looked all over her car, and she didn't know. And I said, yeah, it ended up all over the parking lot. You know, over the parking lot where you left, but it was torn to pieces, and we're putting it back together. And so I asked her, this is not over, and since nothing really happened, we're going to have a little bit of a problem, because if we do this again, it's going to be kind of ineffective. We need to get the name of that demon.
Yes, sir.
And she remembered, this may be helpful. She said that when her church wouldn't help her, she decided to go online to find out how to get rid of demons.
Yes.
But she didn't have a computer, so she went to her friend's computer. And so she went up, looked up a website, and it gave a whole list of demons. And she looked at one that described exactly what was happening to her children. And when she went to look at the name, the computer went off. And so she had to turn it back on,
right,
and then get back on the website, you know, on the internet, back onto the website, find the web page. And again, she went down and looked for the description. And when she went to look at the name again, the second time it went out. Now, this time her friend says, "You're not putting your demons on my computer. You know, it's time to go home." And you know, and then that friend had like a headache for 2 weeks and wouldn't speak to her at all. It had nothing to do with her. And I said, "Oh, okay. So maybe what we could do is, like, give me that name of that website. What I could do is print it up, the list. And then you point out the name, and
right.
then it won't be able to mess it up."
There you go.
And so we set up for the following Friday to do the next exorcism, number two. And so I didn't want to have that list around too long, but Friday was very busy for me. So we were going to do the exorcism in the afternoon, but I was busy all the way till then. And Thursday's my day off, and so I usually on my day off, it was a beautiful day that day, was to go for a bike ride.
Yes, sir.
And so about an hour before I would go on my bike ride, I was trying to, you know, print out that list. And I was doing everything possible. It would not let me print it out, and, you know, trying all kinds of games and everything. And then finally, about an hour later, it printed out, and it was time for my bike ride. And so... and this is probably the most I ever experienced, this particular demon. So the bike ride starts out, and it is a beautiful day, and something was happening that I never see happen before. I was going through my neighborhood, I was kind of on the other side of the street, but someone, you know, across the street there would be so exuberant and say, "Hi, how's it going? Isn't it a beautiful day?" And go down a couple more houses, and someone else, you know, whatever they were out there doing, they would have the same kind of reaction. And, you know, and then I went still, I think, a third place, you know, a neighbor was, and I don't even know these people. And, you know, they, you know, just saying, "Oh, isn't it, what a great day for you to go on a bike ride." You know, so really strange, you know, exuberance and such. And then when I finally got onto the bike path, it seemed like everyone I was passing was, you know, acknowledging me, you know, saying hi, or, you know, thumbs up, or saluting, or, you know, however they would usually kind of, you know, say hi. Or
right.
And usually you may get maybe half the people to do that, you know, half the people might, you know, do that. But it seemed like everyone I was passing. And so I was kind of feeling good, you know, about
sure.
all that. And then I get to the end of the path, and it empties out into this sleepy little street. But this car comes, you know, racing around the corner and slams on the brakes right in front of me. And I pulled out right in front of me. I said, "Oh, you gotta, you know, you gotta be careful here. You know that name." So, and then the whole tenor started to change, because I would get onto this other bike path. And now everyone is, you know, if they do look at me, they're staring at me, like, you know, with a puzzled look, like they're trying to figure out what's riding this bike, you know, type of thing.
Wow.
You know, I remember one time there was a family of four, you know, two bikes, and you just, like, the four sets of eyes are staring at you as you ride by and such, and, you know, and all the, and now occasionally people wouldn't look, you know, so they just drive by. But anyone who looked at me, they just had this stare and, you know, and puzzled look, and I was wondering, what are they seeing?
Right.
You know, so it was really freaking me out, and no one said hi. I mean, it was all, if either ignored me or you stared at me.
Okay, but this all changed when this car screeched and just barely missed you.
Yeah. And so I get to the end of the path, and
yes.
then turn around, and then go through the gate, and all of a sudden I'm thrown to the side of the path. I'm knocked down. And I go, what was that?
You know, right off the bike?
Yeah, I was thrown right off the bike, you know. And then I see my bicycle seat with it's like 45 degrees off. And I said, oh, it's a loose seat.
Yes.
But then I went to turn it. I couldn't turn it. You know, that's pretty solid. And in fact, I had to, you know, go to the gate and pound on it to get it so I could ride it. So it was, you know, super tight. So it wasn't that, but something had the force to move that bicycle seat 45 degrees off and knock me down. And then now, I know one thing was, you know, you can't be intimidated by these things. If it gets you to stop doing it, then, you know, doing what you're doing, because I was kind of thinking maybe I should, you know.
At this point, you had the name of this demon that you were going to use in the exorcism, right?
Exorcism, yeah. And it's
you're lucky you weren't killed.
So that's what I was thinking. So, but I said, well, okay. I mean, I'm sure it would have wanted me to, you know, spill out onto the pavement and, you know, be scraped up and everything.
Yes.
So, but I felt was protected. You know, I did, you know, it was a close call, but I was all right. But then I go about a mile, and there's a series of S-curves, and there's this guy, he's zooming, I mean, he's like all dressed up like Lance Armstrong. He's just focused, looking at the ground. He's pedaling as fast as he could through these series of curves, but he's right in my lane, coming straight toward me, not looking where he's going. And, you know, and I was thinking to myself, do I get out of his way? But I didn't want to, you know, get into a dance with him.
You know? Uh-huh.
And so I was about ready to jump off the bike, and he looks up and then gets out of the way. You know, I go, oh, man, that was almost a head-on collision. I mean, on a bike. I mean, wow. You know, so and then I go another mile, and we come to there's these two mothers towing their babies in these little bike trailers. And so they go through the gate and line up on the street there, and then the yellow one comes through. But they take up that whole area, and it's the only place where, you know, there's a ditch on either side. So I don't go to that one. I couldn't get in between them. I go to the other side, and there's maybe about a foot or so to get around them as they're waiting for this car. But I'm kind of shaking and such, and I just got thrown, you know, off the side, and I'm kind of praying, please don't throw me into their babies and such, you know, silently. And the car passes, and then I do go around them, and then I hear them say, I'm sorry, because there was another bike coming across the street, but I think he had to stop right in the middle of the street so that one of them could get out of the way so he could get by. And so, but I was, you know, thinking, you know, okay, at least I didn't, you know, that didn't happen.
Yes.
And so I go about another mile or two, and there's this mother with her little boy, maybe like 3 years old. He's pulling a plastic wagon behind him. They're in the other lane. And so I'm about ready to pass them. And all of a sudden, the boy decides to dart out in front of me. But luckily, the mother just as quickly grabs him and to not go. Because if she didn't do that and he just would dart, I mean, I wouldn't go in front of him, but I would have to go behind him and hit his wagon and send him flying, or, you know, send me flying and everything
at
else.
Some point in all of this, Father, aren't you beginning to realize this is way not normal?
Yeah.
I mean,
oh, yeah.
Something's
no, this was 20 bullets, and I know I can't stop it, because if it knows I will stop at this point, it has the upper hand. You know, it knows what will get me to stop. And so I have to keep on plugging along.
Yes.
And then we come to, there's this bike tunnel under a very busy street, and it's kind of a narrow bike tunnel. And there's it was the last day of school, and so there was either a set of kindergarten kids, they're small kids, or there was there's also a nursery kind of school, a kitty corner on the other side. But as I was going down into this bike tunnel, and it was a bright sunny day, and so as my eyes are adjusting, I hear, get to the wall. And all of a sudden I see about 15 kids. Luckily, they all go to the one wall, and I could, you know, get into the other lane and go past them all. And then I'm also hoping that another bike's not zooming down the on the other side. And then and luckily there wasn't.
So you were headed straight for those kids.
Yeah, so, and luckily, and if the kids didn't, you know, they all went, some went one way, some went the other way, some froze. I mean, it would have been disastrous.
Right.
I don't think I could, you know.
Couldn't have avoided them.
Mm-hmm. Well, boy, yeah, so it would have just, something. And also, if a bike was coming down the other side, I mean, we either would collide. I don't know. It would have really been tight mm-hmm. squeeze. So it was, and I got, you know, beyond that, and I was saying, man, was that dangerous? Why would you? But luckily, the kids did, you know, obey their teacher and knew right. where to go and everything. I was like, oh, boy, was that, you know, and I go, man, you know, and luckily, that was the last thing, because I don't remember anything, I mean, even seeing another person after that. So, but it was, I mean,
that was plenty.
I was plenty bullet. It was.
That's an incredible, incredible story. Okay, so you've yeah. got the name of this mm-hmm. demon, and you've still got your life in your hands. Barely. So there's one more exorcism coming, I take it, and this would be the one.
This one, I used the name. So before, you know, so again, it was like, nothing happened, got to the, you know, with the crucifix, nothing happened. And then I asked for its name, and nothing was said. Then I said, is your name such and such? And then she began convulsing.
Wow.
And then once I had that, then I just kept on using that name over and over, you know, and she got more and more, you know, the convulsions got bigger and bigger. And then eventually they kind of lessened and she fell asleep. And so that took care of that one.
Whew, that one. Have there been others since?
Yeah, so we kind of knew, we took care of the, she never spoke. So we kind of knew, you know, the kids would do these rhyming type of things. And so there was a speaking demon with the kids, also the levitating one or the throwing one, you know. So we knew that one was still kind of there. And so and since we had no other name, well, we did have another name. She kind of pointed it out.
All right, now you're confusing me a little. You exorcised the demon in her,
mm-hmm.
right? In mom. But even that done, you're saying the children still experienced?
Yeah, so the children were still experiencing, these things in their, where they were at in the foster care and such.
Even there.
So we knew the, and she didn't manifest those. And so we decided to go to the Latin exorcism.
Mm-hmm.
And the old rite. Let's just try that. And so when we did that one,
this was on the child. This was, excuse me, on the child or children?
No, they were still locked up. They were still, you know, away from her.
Yes.
So we're going to see if we wanted to get, you know, them all out of her, so that, and then see if, then work on the children once we had access to them. And so the next plan was to do it in Latin, the old rite.
Okay, again, you're talking about LaToya?
With LaToya, yeah.
So when you got one demon out, you did that by name, the name you had retrieved, right?
And
so that demon
was out. That one was out, yeah.
But that wasn't the only one.
So there was seemed to be so she felt there was six of them in her, but but you know we were kind of trying to identify them by personality, you know, look at like what the kids did. So one would seem to make them do rhymes, one would throw them around, one would now we're not sure if the throwing around is with the levitating,
yes.
You know, so those didn't manifest yet. So we thought we had to at least deal with those. And so would do the one in Latin. Now, the interesting thing with the Latin one was I was the only one who knew Latin. Uh-huh. And, in fact, there was someone who would do the responses, but I had to train her how to phonetically
right.
do those responses. So she right. didn't know what she was saying. She was just,
saying it.
And so what was interesting is as long as you were praising God, it didn't bother this one. But when you started condemning it, then she would convulse again. And so, it would know, and immediately when he went to praising God again, it would stop.
Did you have a name that you were after this time or not?
No, I was just doing the Latin right.
I understand.
It didn't give me a name.
Okay.
But it was reacting. So it was going back and forth, and that happens three times. And so I decided just to do the condemnation part of the right
uh-huh.
and just attack the demon because it just can't stand it. And so it got more and more violent, her convulsions. And then, like before, then it finally dissipated. And then she finally fell asleep. And then when that was happening, I saw that she was trying to speak something, say something. Her mouth was moving,
right.
but nothing was coming out. And she also mentioned she felt like, did she lift up? She felt something was trying to lift her up. I said, no, we didn't see her lift. But she's not, it's in a church, so it's hard to get the energy that they need to do that. And also, she's a bigger woman, a little different with a child. And so we weren't sure if those left or not.
All right, I'll tell you what, we're right up against a break. We've got one more segment to go, Father. So take it easy. I'm sure this is not easy to talk about. Every time I think I'm hearing the end of the story, it's like a horror movie. You know, there's more. It just keeps coming. But maybe that is the way it is.
Dark Matter News. I'm Leo Ashcraft. Police are warning of Flacca zombies. They're raising awareness after an encounter with a man on the street with the drug Flacca caused him to lash out uncontrollably like a zombie. It's a street drug coming to us from China, and it's being called bath salts on steroids, which is scary when remembering what happened with that face-eating event down in Florida. $3 to $5 a dose, Flacca takes the form of crystals that can be snorted, injected, vaporized, or eaten, according to the National Institute of Drug Abuse. And it's this ease of retrieval and use that is cause for concern. The drug takes control of the user and sends them into violent, uncontrollable fits, as witnessed by two Southern Illinois police officers last month. The event captured on their body cameras shows a naked man, allegedly high on Flacca, violently thrashing around his home, flipping over furniture, banging into walls, yelling and avoiding all attempts by police to subdue him. They used stun guns to try to subdue the 51-year-old, but by the time medical assistance arrived at the scene, the man had already overdosed and was beyond saving. Flacca use is especially high in Broward County, Florida, where there were 477 reported cases in 2014 alone. This raises concerns that the drug is more dangerous than meth because it is so easy to use and so cheap and so new that law enforcement and medical science is having trouble keeping up. The Weather Channel has just released a video of an event captured on camera in 2003. 12 years ago, a lake in Kentucky produced a spectacular phenomenon as nature's rapid response to an accident caused a lightning strike at the nearby Jim Beam manufacturing facility. The chain reaction started shortly after the strike when runoff from the blaze accumulated in nearby lakes. The fiery bourbon, attributing a key ingredient to this cocktail, alongside a tornado, spawned an extremely rare event known as a firenado. Firefighters were able to dam up a creek and contain the blaze. The ecological impact of the Jim Beam accident affecting local fish and wildlife has cost environmental cleanup efforts approximately $70,000 since the 2003 event. The distillery only lost about 2% of its reserves in the blast, and according to the Kentucky Distillers Association, it remains the largest bourbon producer in the state. Take a look at the video. An amazing firenado comprised of bad luck and bourbon at darkmatternews.com. Physicists at the Autonomous University of Barcelona have demonstrated for the first time a wormhole allowing two regions of space to be connected magnetically. The study published in Nature revealed that the experiment was conducted using two magnetic monopoles, which aren't observably evident in nature. The poles created a sort of warp in which an object appeared to traverse space outside of the normal three-dimensional realms into what can only be described as a fourth dimension. Researchers used a tri-layer model to sandwich superconducting material between two sheets of ferromagnetic material in the shape of a sphere to create the wormhole. According to one researcher, the device changes the topology of space, as if the inner region has been magnetically erased from space. Unlike prior models implemented by the team in 2014, this wormhole's magnetic field cannot be detected by diagnostic devices. Speculative applications for this model outside of gravitational applications in interstellar space could be applied in the future of magnetic resonance imaging in medicine, improving efficiency of MRIs, and even perhaps allow for remote body scans of patients. You can check out this in-depth article put together by Haunted Skeptic at darkmatternews.com. I'm Leo Ashcraft, Dark Matter News.
So, Father, is this where it ends? Is this the end of the story? I have thought that the story was ending any number of times, and then something awful happened again.
Yes, yeah, so after the third one, we just kind of would always kind of set up for everyone present, you know, when we can meet again, if need be. And so at that time, it was around 4th of July. And so there was so everyone had plans and, you know, different things. So we're kind of working out when she could get back. She, you know, the third was a possibility, or that Friday again.
Right.
And so, and we kind of got everyone's schedules so they could do, you know, the third or that Friday. And I think the fourth was on a Thursday. So so we were going to wait for her to let us know which day she preferred, if need be. And so she never called us back. And so there was like no news is good news.
Right.
And so... so we never really heard from her. Next time I would hear from her was in October. She would give me a call that she's having her final hearing for her children and to get them back. And if I could give her a rosary. And I said, oh, sure, okay. And I was kind of expecting to, you know, see her after her hearing and then talk about how everything was going. But for some reason, she didn't even show up for the rosary, or so I didn't never heard anything until, you know, after the story broke, and I found out that she did get her children back. They had a big party in November, celebrating that, and that things have been fine ever since. And it seemed like it stopped, you know, affecting the children after her final exorcism.
I see.
So,
I understand that you have no book. You didn't write a book. You have no website. But there are plans apparently, to make a movie of this story. Is that correct?
Yeah, a documentary is in its final stages of completion. And that's with Zach Bagans doing in fact, he could almost do it in two parts. He has so much material, it's really hard to kind of keep it, because he wants to keep it to like a feature-length documentary, movie-length, so to 2.5 hours. But he, you know, but he's finding it very difficult to keep it, get it down to that.
All
but
right.
So that's in the plans, and also there was a plan for a movie, but that was Relativity was going to be the company doing it, and they went bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of opening up, you know, for other companies to kind of get back into that picture there. But right now it's kind of tied up in the bankruptcy
thing. I see. So, well, I can understand why they'd want to make a movie of it, that's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Oof. So
this rate's right up there. I mean, it unfolds slowly, but in the totality of the story, it is absolutely terrifying. God. One quick question. The, in quotes, boyfriend, what became of him, or did he just, like, disappear?
Yeah, Zach did try to interview him, and wanted to give him equal time and such if
equal
he
time.
Wanted to dispute anything or whatever. And he wasn't interested. And I did say, you know, most likely because he's probably possessed and would probably need an exorcism himself and maybe even his wife. And if they wanted that, you know, I would be willing to help them out that way.
Uh-huh.
And Zach even proposed that to him, and he thought about it for a while and then decided, you know, against that, you know, so he, but he didn't come out kicking and screaming that, you know, he's going to sue us, that we're defaming
right.
him or anything like that. So
right.
he seemed to, consider what we were going to propose, and but in the end decided against it.
Is there anything else you wanted to get in that we didn't include in the interview? It was certainly a very detailed interview.
Mm-hmm.
Did we get it all in?
Well, there is also probably the other aspect, because it also affects the house. The house, it is kind of a perfect storm. And as I mentioned, the policeman discovered that there was the basement was poured concrete, but underneath the stairs it was broken and it was sand, and so we were thinking, when I went and blessed the house and that, I didn't realize that was underneath the stairs, and so I said we do need to see what's. Something's buried in there, so we need to figure what that is. And there is mention, because the Amens would also be seeing kind of, you know, there was the guy coming up and down the stairs with the,
right.
even the footprints. There was also the boy, the youngest boy, was always talking to this other boy in the closet that only he would see.
Right, so did they dig?
And so they, so we, first of all, got a dog, and the dog didn't react to anything. So we then started to dig. And about, there seems to be two levels, about 2 feet deep and 2.5 feet deep. So
yes.
The 2 feet deep would have meant the second thing that was buried. And it was coming up with things kind of relating to an older woman.
What?
First of all, the first thing we found was a fingernail.
Ugh.
And like we weren't sure if it's a real fingernail. We were thinking it was an applique, you know, fake fingernail for a woman. But we weren't positive on that yet. And then the next thing we found was it looked like a pair of old woman's panties or a slip. some sort of undergarment.
Yes.
But it was kind of old. It was very plain as far as cottony. You know, it was very sandy, but it was not a fancy thing. But it was kind of something that you would think would be around the war,
yes.
World War II or Depression era.
Right.
And then we found also the third thing was this red, looked like a top of a tea kettle. And we were looking for the, you know, container, but we didn't find anything there. So there was three objects that seemed to be to an older woman. Then we went about 2.5 feet deep.
Yes.
And then we found a pair of like boys' socks. And what was interesting, we didn't realize it till later, but when we saw it, it looked like the ankle portions of the sock and the foot portion we thought was cut off. Later on, we would discover that it, actually the foot portion of the sock was tucked in underneath the ankle portion. And it was the ankle was, again, like a cottony sock that would be around the, you know, 30s or 40s, you know, very plain.
Listen, Father, at this point, I would be thinking somewhere under there is a body.
Yeah. So that's why the policemen were doing this.
I see.
Then the next thing we found was this weight. And it weighed about, it was heavy metal, 10 pounds or so, all corroded, been there a long time. Had a little hook-like thing at the top.
Yes,
we're trying to figure out what it was. And maybe the thing is that weight to a grandfather's clock. But that house didn't seem like that kind of type, and it wasn't that big. And then they were kind of saying, the Gary policeman said, you know, in these old houses, they used to, for the cord to open the drapes, they would put this weight on it and to hold the cord down. And then the next thing we found was this long brown thing. Now they were thinking, oh, this looks like a bone, you know. And so they were going very carefully, taking pictures.
Yes.
You know, and sweep, you know, brushing and all this kind of stuff, going very easy on it. Then they kind of tapped it and sound plastic-like. And so they pulled it up, and it looked like it's one of those old-time shoehorns, but it was, for some reason, was broken in half.
Okay.
Lengthwise. And so, so we were kind of thinking that these look like objects that would be tied to necromancy, to conjuring up the dead, you know.
Right.
And so the first thing that was buried was probably we were trying to find out if the house was first sold, was built in 1926 and sold to a newlywed couple. And we were trying to find out if they ever had a boy, you know. And we haven't been able to find that yet. But we're maybe thinking if that's the boy that was appearing in the closet, that maybe he accidentally killed himself by, you know, maybe twirling around that weight and it conked him in the head or went off the wall and knocked him out or, you know, wrapped around his neck or something like that and choked him. So that might have been the thing that killed him. You know, with his socks and, you know, tied to the feet type of thing. So, and the other one could have been either the woman's mother, because the kids also, when they came off the bus one time and coming home from school, they saw this old lady in their backyard, and they came and, you know, they were walking back to her and going to ask her, what are you doing in our backyard? And when she turned around, she had red eyes. and so they ran into the house and got their mother and grandmother, and they came running out, and she wasn't there. And a second time, they saw the woman in the backyard, and they came running into the house to try to get their mother to go out there, and again, it was missing. So there seemed to be three human ghost-like figures tied to the house as well. So it's kind of a perfect storm.
Does that house now stand alone? Is there somebody living in it now, or what's become of it?
Zach Bagans bought the house, and it is interesting. He kind of boarded it up because it's very active, and in fact, he was doing some filming on it this past winter, and one of the cameramen ended up seeing this like goat head thing, and he quit. And he went back to it. he gave up on the project.
It's amazing. Have you, Father, stopped doing exorcisms, or have you done others? I mean, you've done it once, and people know you have done them. Mm-hmm. You probably get requests for them, don't you?
Yeah. So I did do three others.
Three.
Beside that one.
Each one you went to, did you go back to the bishop?
Each one. All four were approved by the bishop. The one was tied to the house. So that one I had permission for, anything, with that house, I have permission for. But, the other two were, two separate people, two separate cases.
Mm-hmm. I have never heard, I've never heard anything like this story, Father. It's just amazing. I don't know what to say about it. There's very little I can say about it. It is what it is, and what it is sounds to me like clearly possession. And clearly, do you think it's completely gone, Father, or are you still concerned?
No, we're still concerned because, in fact, when after the cameraman incident, he boarded up the house.
Right.
He didn't want anyone there messing with it. And now we recently did some more filming, so they unboarded it. And when they walked inside, they saw no one has been in there since the wintertime. And so there's dust on this table. But then there's this handprint with long fingers.
It just never ends, does it?
And also, there was this hole in the ceiling.
Oh,
and so they were thinking some animal, like a raccoon or something, must have dug a hole. It knocked all this, debris and such to the ground, and all kinds of water and mold and everything kind of got in there. And they were looking for the animal that would have done that, and they couldn't find anything. And they didn't see any exit. It didn't climb up the wall again. So it either just, for some reason, dug a hole in the roof so that the water could get all in. So, the house is kind of ruined now.
Father, as I said way back in the show, I would imagine something of this magnitude would be an affirmation of your faith. Yes?
Yes.
I want to thank you for being on the program. It has been incredible to hear this story unwind. Just absolutely incredible. Thank you.
Yeah. You're welcome, Sherhart. Thank you.
Good night, Father. Wow. You just heard a story of possession and exorcism. The real thing.
At night in the desert.
Okay. That one got to me. Tomorrow we will do open lines of some description. I don't know what it's going to be. I'll pray on it. Good night, everybody.
Searching for the truth. Will we make it to tomorrow? Will the sun shine on you? We're listening to you.
been looking for the answers. All my life I felt you there. As the world we live in quickens, are we heeding all the signs? Have we lost our intuition? Are we running out of time? Midnight in the desert,